We're with Christine Borland. We're in a sort of green glade at the side of St. Peter's Church, which is down behind the Landers Museum. This is a very distinctive and a very beautiful spot to have. Did you choose this particular location for your work? And if you did, if you actually were involved in the choice of the location, or we just offered it, and if you were, did you... what reason did you want to choose it for?
Yes, it was chosen very carefully because it relates specifically to the piece. There were several other sites I considered initially because the piece was making a reference to the practice of anatomy in the medical facility of the university in Munster. So I was looking at the different sites from the very start of anatomy as a discipline within the university to like right up to the present time. So as well as the building having been destroyed twice in two wars, it's also sort of moved and expanded, of course, as the facility grew. So where we are now was actually the first place where the first anatomy department in Munster was established in 1839 on this exact spot. So the name of the piece is The Dead Teach the Living, or Mortui Vivos Docent, if you want to give it its sort of Latin name. And that title is taken from an inscription which is on the wall of the current anatomy dissection theatre within the university in Munster. So after researching all these other sites that had a link to the history of this anatomy, I chose this one because in relation to my title, The Dead Teach the Living, it would seem very relevant that we're here on a site which on the one hand looks onto the university library. It's surrounded by sort of university buildings, and as you said, we're adjacent to the Petra Kirche here on the left. So there's a lot of references to kind of teaching and learning on this site, as well as the fact that it is actually a kind of, you know, there's a bit of an air of tranquility here where hopefully these thoughts, you know, you can have time to kind of mull all that over.
Then it's a very charged site, and it's I saw it immediately as a sort of idyllic spot, really, which it is, but in fact it's a place charged with all sorts of memories, and in fact the idea of memory and the idea of the recollection of times past and of reflection upon what has happened here is something which informs a lot of the work in this project. Again and again one comes against this particular theme, if you like, and here in a very personal, very individual way, you're in a way actually dealing with that theme, perhaps at one remove. But The Dead Teach the Living, of course, has to do with the notion that maybe we might learn from history as well as we might learn from the bodies of the dead, that in that very practical sense that an anatomist has to deal with. But we might learn from history, and we might not learn from history seems to be really another one of the themes. And that this, not just this site, which we now know has had a building on it and no longer has a building on it, but all through, wherever you go in Munster, of course, you're coming across places which had buildings which no longer have them, or places where there has been this incredible destruction. I find this a very moving piece. I think it's extraordinary, the sort of silence of the dialogue between, if you like, these heads. Could you describe them to us, describe the actual piece to us, and then say something about how you created it?
Okay, the piece consists of seven representations of heads. They're made in a rather sort of strange, well, I feel as if it's got kind of futuristic feel to it. It's a plastic material as opposed to a more traditional sort of kind of way of presenting things that have been cast, you know, for example, bronze or plaster. So that's important in terms of what we were talking about, time. So there's, you know, the piece I feel because of the material that it's made of, its associations are kind of going forward, yet, as you're saying, it has many historical references too. So the seven heads are actually all heads that were taken from, as I said before, I think, the collection of the Anatomical Institute here in Munster. The Anatomical Institute is in a building that was built in the 50s after the one from the wartime was destroyed. So I went there, you know, very early on, just as part of my general research, along with a number of other sort of places to just try to kind of cast around to start thinking about the project. And I was really interested in the fact that it was very kind of contemporary teaching collection. You know, it wasn't a sort of historical museum that's open to the public, it's just for teaching the students, but they did have one or two historical pieces in the collection. So they told me that these were things from what had been a very extensive and good collection, but it had been destroyed in the war, and that they had lost the histories of many of these objects that they did have. So these particular heads were in that category.
It's a loss within a loss then, isn't it? I mean, it's an extraordinary sort of echoing of the whole thing. And thematically, it must have been very, very interesting for you. I think one of the things about the piece is that the material you've used for the heads has almost a sort of translucent feel to it, and it gives them a rather ghostly presence. So one of the other things is that they're set on these concrete plinths, just in the way in which a commemorative sculpture might be, you know, with your bronze head, just the bronze head. And yet these, although, as you said, the material itself picks up on possibilities of modelling and so on, which didn't exist in the past and which is a sort of modern technology, if you like, literally informing and forming these heads. At the same time, the actual material, as I said, has this extraordinary sort of translucence or a sort of glow to it, which gives them a sort of ghostly feel. And that's what I said, they also are facing in various directions, as if they might be in a sort of ghostly dialogue. And, you know, this, if I may say it, this picks up for me in a way upon the Nam June Park piece, you know, where similarly a configuration of things, you know, that have gone are in a sort of dialogue together or there, you know, and that silver paint. So I bring this up because one of the things that strikes me about this piece and about what's going on in the project in general is the way in which artists, in a way, not necessarily deliberately, but have... We find artists in this project talking to each other in these different ways across, as if the town and as if its histories have sort of determined a way in which people might respond to the challenge of trying to find a way of making sculpture for a public place here.
After an initial dialogue was started with the anatomy department, I had to find a way of thinking about how to actually reproduce these. So it was entirely made with this slightly hands-off, I suppose, kind of process again, which I was interested in because I feel, I mean, I didn't find out the exact histories of these objects, but, you know, generally, as well as, I think if you're anywhere dealing with the image of the face or the head within anatomy, within medicine, you know, of course you're touching on, you know, a very huge kind of and difficult area. But here in Germany, in this kind of context with the histories of, you know, studying race, studying anthropology here in Germany, you know, you're touching on a whole load of kind of other things too. So somehow that kind of slightly one step removed from the original seemed to me to fit very well with the idea that you're dealing with the past, but you're almost presenting something, you know, rather new. You know, there is I suppose there's something a little bit more optimistic rather than if I had cast these in plaster, say, and presented them again.
I wonder if you might not just say now very briefly something about the individual heads. Is that possible?
This one is... I think from a male of South African origin, Hottentot, and the other one is probably from the Dayaks, who are inhabitants of Borneo. So they're two, which unfortunately are going to come late, but they're a very important part of the piece. There are two for which there's the same description. This is one here and the one over there. So they appear to me, the originals were in clay, and which had not been fired, so it was in quite a bad state of repair, of course, falling apart. But I could see coming through that a structure of something beneath. And from work that I've done in the past, I think it was this process of you take a plaster cast of a skull and you build up. There's a sort of established method to build up an image from the skull. So these I have called typical Nordic profiles, which they kind of certainly are. And of course that's a very sort of loaded thing to say. The one here over here is kind of a contemporary of Neanderthal man, but he's from an area near Peking in China, Sinanthropus pekinensis is his full title. The one in the middle is a death mask. It was a head and shoulders plaster cast from a child with a disease called microcephalus. The name microcephalus Schroeder was written on the bust, but I was unable, although I did try very hard, I was unable to find out whether that was the name of the child. You know, Schroeder was the family name of the child, or if it might be the person who kind of was investigating that particular strain of this disease. And the one over here is the one that I have absolutely no idea anything at all about it. It was a plaster bust, head and shoulders again. It was obviously not a cast from Death or Life. It looks like a rather bad artist's clay that's been then cast into a plaster. It has no apparent anthropological or anatomical interest at all. So that remains the one that is a very big question mark.
Sort of joker in the pack. One thing that does strike me is that you do have this sort of succession of heads, and that the one that you said, which has been done twice, is very like, say, a head of Liszt or, you know, some sort of romantic composer or something. So there's a sort of thing there, I think, that also, you know, that the notion of that is the highest you can get, you know, the head of the great composer, probably German, you know.
Yeah, these are the ones, because of that sort of strength of character in them somehow, that we most kind of identify with, you know, familiar images of, you know, important men cast in bronze on plinths.
So, in that way, it sort of does add to the irony, the visual irony of the whole piece. We're in a piece of parkland just beyond the limits of the Schlossgarten. In an open space is Hermann de Vries's sanctuarium. It's a circular wall which encloses a garden. There is no gateway through the wall. One can look into the garden through four oval apertures set at right angles on the circumference. Inside is a wild garden, that is to say, nothing has been planted, but what has planted itself, seeded itself. So the sanctuary is, in a sense, a sanctuary for nature itself. There's no way in which anybody can enter this garden from now on to interfere with what the birds and the wind bring into it. So although we're looking at a rather stark, circular wall, one imagines that in 20 years or so there will be young trees visible above that wall. At the top of the wall there's a kind of overhang in concrete, upon which is written in a Sanskrit statement from the Upanishads. This is perfect and that is perfect. Perfect comes from perfect. Take perfect from perfect, and perfect is the remainder. Inscription is inscribed into the stone of the coping around the top of the wall in, I think, three places. So this perfect circle encloses something which is now beyond, in a sense, beyond human touch, and something which can be seen and observed but not interfered with.
The scale of the piece, I think that from the ground to the top of the coping, it's about 3 metres, about 9 yeah. to 10 feet. And the diameter is, again, about 12 to 15 metres, 30 to 40 feet. And the effect is that the physical scale certainly couldn't penetrate this enclosed area. One certainly couldn't get into it, and that's the intention, that it is entirely operating according to the devices of nature, as you say, in terms of how seed blows into it, how birds will drop seed. And although at the moment there's very little growing in it, there's a few wild flowers and wild vegetables, as time goes on it'll become presumably very profuse.
One of the interesting things about it is that it actually is itself quite monumental. It's like a round blockhouse almost. I mean, it is very much a human intervention into this parkland space. It's very, as I said, at the moment quite stark. It's very deliberate as a piece. There's nothing sort of, if you like, hippie-ish about its protection of the enclosed garden. It's like a fortification around a piece of wild nature. So there are these contradictions which the piece itself invites one to contemplate.
It is one of the few pieces that is going to be permanent here.
Well, I mean, it would make no sense unless it were going to be more or less permanent, or shall we say as permanent as anything is. I'm in the Landesmuseum with Herman de Vries. Herman, would you say something about this particular piece, For Munster, and the way in which perhaps you see it relating to the general project here in Munster?
I came to Munster about a year ago and we searched for several projects. At the end, we decided to realize the sanctuarium and found a spot in a park. A park, in fact, is for me, it's culturally made poor nature. Mm-hmm. When you imagine what could be growing in a park on plants when it was not a park and cultivated, then it was a much more rich situation as that we now find in parks. So we placed a wall, a round wall with no entrance. It, in fact, it protects the inside from the cultivated outside. The sanctuarium comes from sanctus, holy. And also, in English, sanctuary is a nature reservation. Yeah. It reflects also my attitude towards nature and the life of nature, what I feel a very large respect for.
In a sense, then, it is a protected ground in which nature itself can develop according to its own laws, its own rhythms.
Yes, that it is.
One can envisage trees, perhaps, growing in that island.
Yes, we wait for it. I don't know if the first tree will be there in 3 years or in 13 years, but once it will be full of trees. Because the tree, the forest, is the end situation of a vegetation development almost everywhere. A forest can remain a stable society for many centuries.
It is a walled garden in one sense. You know that the word paradise comes from the Persian for a walled garden.
Yes. Well, I have not directed myself so much on the garden as well on the temple structure. In fact, I could call this the first Hessian cult building in this bishop town for more as 1,000 years. So it is also a confrontation with a complete other attitude, reality, nature and religion.
In conceiving of this piece, how did you see it as relating to the Munster project and to the general scheme of things here?
I think it fits very good in the Munster project because they see it very wide. And I agree with this. The art in our century and certainly in the last 10, 20 years developed in many directions. It's very open and that's a very good thing.
The piece is a perfect ring.
Yeah.
And you quote from the Upanishads.
Yes, yes. It's also nothing again. It can go in or go out. A ring is a perfect form.
Yes.
And yes, I have long thought by my first sanctuarium in Stuttgart what form I should give. But the only form I could make was the ring.
Yes.
Also right. For my feeling. And it's not only a kind of argument. It's also a kind of feeling.
The whole piece is situated in the forecourt, the large forecourt of the castle in Munster. Great Baroque house facing a smallish open park and facing across to the twin towers of the cathedral. The piece consists of a large number of American model cars, American cars dating from the 20s to the 50s. They're all painted a uniform silver, matte silver. The effect is of an extraordinary sort of ghostly company, especially as the cars become more and more streamlined. So the stillness of them in this palace forecourt becomes all the more poignant, I think, all the more strange, because the suggestion of speed, the whole look of the thing as ultra modern, suddenly become obsolete, become very old fashioned, and one of the groups is that of cars from the 20s, and these are configured as a circle facing inwards. Again, as if in some sort of ghostly conversation with each other. The music that is playing from them is Mozart's Requiem. So you have a sort of Baroque masterpiece in front of a Baroque masterpiece. And as it were, being sung by a choir of ghostly and angelic silver cars. It's a very strange, extraordinary sort of installation. It's a show stealer, really, Bill.
Each car is full of the paraphernalia of early technology, of television screens, chassis for radios and so on, packed. In fact, so you can see it from the front window.
Yes. Yeah. Every car is completely packed to the windows. Only the front windows, incidentally, are left as glass. The side windows, as with everything else, tyres, spokes, every accessory are painted a uniform silver. So you have these cars as it were, repositories of the advanced technology of the mid-century.
I'm Carl Solway from the Carl Solway Gallery, and I've been Namjoon Paik's dealer for the past 15 years.
Tell us about this piece that we've just heard about from Mel Gooding.
Well, we have here 32 cars, all American cars, eight of them from the 1920s, eight of them from the 30s, eight from the 40s, and eight from the 50s. He decided on using 32 cars because 1932 was the year he was born, and this piece is a requiem to the 20th century, and of course the sound is Mozart's Requiem playing. The cars have all been painted silver. They reflect the sunlight in front of this Baroque castle, which is now the university. Interesting, it's about education, and the piece is something didactic about the century. The silver cars reflect the industrial age, the color of steel and metal and production and weapons, and this sort of silver shadowy kind of quality to them. They almost look like tin toys sitting out here. They're sort of artifacts and relics, but they're the real thing. And inside the cars are, they're all filled with broken television sets. And, of course, Peck is thinking about television as an obsolete material as well as we come to the end of the 20th century. But now we're into the 21st century, and television is obsolete. It's the computer age and the internet. And our hopes for international access and understanding through the vehicle of television has now been supplanted by the vehicle of the internet, which is more instantaneous and more personal and more one-to-one, and provides that new opportunity for international understanding.
Could you say anything about the configuration of the cars on the front here?
The arrangement is arbitrary. It was a formal decision of how to dominate the space and occupy the this beautiful bricked plaza in front of this U-shaped symmetrical Baroque castle. And so he wanted the installation to be in conflict with symmetry, and the pieces to be, the groupings to be non-symmetrical, and yet to spread out even to the edges of the two ends of the U. So the installation was somewhat arbitrary and somewhat thinking about formal questions.
Sitting at the moment on Bert Theis's philosophical platform, it consists of a ramp painted very, very bright white. From either side, one can actually ascend by steps to the horizontal platform. It's aligned at right angles to the line that runs through and from the Baroque castle to the cathedral in the Domplatz. It's called philosophical platform, I take it, because it's actually white neutral and makes no statement beyond the fact, perhaps through some sort of mechanism, the artist's heartbeat has been magnified into something that sounds like the thunder in a thunderstorm. So there's that much of him present, as it were. But philosophical platform would seem to imply that we're talking here about a position adopted, a platform as in a political platform. And this piece is clearly, in a sense, in opposition to that whole notion. Its whiteness, its neutrality, would seem to indicate that you can approach it from any angle, that once on it, you are on your own platform. It makes no statement of its own beyond that. Becomes a sort of stage, if you like, for behavior, a place to sit or stand and conduct a conversation, an object upon which you become that which is seen, as well as being a platform from which you can actually see other things. I mean, in formal terms, it actually is a very beautiful intervention, because if you stand with your back to the back of the castle, it becomes a pure white abstract structure against the green trees. If you go to the other side of it and view it with the rear facade of the castle behind it, then it also, because it's so sharply aligned with the centre of this symmetric facade, emphasises that symmetry, and yet it has this pure white modernist feel to it against the elaboration of the Baroque facade. So it's, I think, a very thought-provoking piece. in some ways might be a typical piece for this whole project, insofar as the notion of taking a position, of occupying a position, is something that seems very much to be against the spirit of this particular sculpture project. It's not about the imposition of an artist's ideas in some sort of material form upon the landscape. It's much more about creating situations in which people in the town, visitors to the project, can relate themselves. So this philosophical platform is everybody's platform.
As well as a philosophic platform, the artist talks about it having other functions, and behind us there are children on bikes. Absolutely. And there's a recreational function that's somehow embraced here too.
And that sort of willingness on the part of the artist to allow the spectator, a person who encounters the work, to do what he or she wants with it, is something, which I think is part and parcel of the prevailing spirit in this particular project. And I think a lot of the things I think we're going to encounter and we have seen are things which encourage a sort of behavioural response, encourage the use of them as, if you like, things for either physical or imaginative play.
I presume you're making a reference now back to the debate around Documenta.
Yes, I am. To the extent that we're in both of these sort of enterprises, what's coming across very strongly is the sense that meanings now have to be made by the spectator. I mean, we've always known that to be, to some extent, true, of course, but I think here in a much more open-ended way. What is very striking is that the discussion that seems to be encouraged by both Documenta and by this project is the discussion about the possibility of diverse meanings for any work, the possibility of diverse uses for any work, and also the way in which the work should enter into the processes by which people become free. It's quite a difficult position for the artist, but it certainly seems to be something that many of the artists contributing here and to Documenta, and the things that are picked up historically in Documenta, very much have to do with those artists, I think, who if you like, through the 60s, 70s, pioneered that notion that we have to determine meanings for ourselves, that we can't, we shouldn't allow them to be imposed upon us. And we shouldn't think that somebody else can do it for us. Here comes the heartbeat again. Thank you.
Tommaso Corvimone, Robert Prime.
Tommaso, here we are at the reception for Munster Sculpture Project. Have you seen anything here that has particularly impressed you?
Well, I've seen some works I really liked. The first one that springs to mind is Roman Signor's walking stick. That was really nice. Sort of worked really well. I tried to spot the Maurizio Catalan's corpse, but it was a bit difficult to see. But he told me that it's going to get better and it's going to be more visible, and maybe not, depending on the rain, basically. And I mean, it's nice. I really like the fact that it takes time to walk from one piece to the other. So it gives you time to think about it. It's the first time I come to Münster for this. So it was really good. I mean, I'm just starting, so I'll take the next day to sort of finish it off.
You're in Documenta?
Yeah.
And on reflection, it's a few days ago now. How do you feel about that?
I don't know. It was quite interesting because there were very conflicting opinions about Documenta. So, you know, some people were saying that it was nostalgic and kind of and were very disappointed. And some other people said that it sort of held together quite well and that it was actually quite interesting. I mean, my opinion is that I just like it very much when I can see four or five really good works in an exhibition. I mean, no matter what the scale is. I mean, it's not that makes it more interesting or less interesting. I think it's already a success. So I enjoyed it. I mean, I think it was interesting and it was very personal. So
I noticed Liam Gillick had two installations, yes, in the old railway station, and he shows with your gallery, Robert Prime, in London. How do you think that worked?
I think it worked really well because, in the context of the whole exhibition, I think it made sense because his work, I think it resonated in a very interesting way with Pistoletto on one side, and I think they do share some sort of common preoccupations, especially with a minus object. And I think it was interesting because his work is somehow concerned with formalism, but in a very kind of oblique way. And it's not about that. And it was the only work that somehow I think had that stance in that part of the exhibition, at least. But it was very interesting to see it together with Pistoletto. I think that part of the installation worked really well. I mean, that floor, I think it was very interesting.
So, Sabina Rus, you're originally from Germany, from Leipzig. Now you are a critic and a writer on art, living in New York. You were in Documenta, mm-hmm, and now here we are in Münster. Do you have any views on, to begin with, Documenta, and now, mm-hmm, the Münster Sculpture Project?
Personally, I actually didn't really have like a precise expectation about Documenta. I went there totally open, didn't really know what to expect, and it was a big surprise for me actually, because it seems like a very historical show and I didn't know that this would happen. And in the beginning, I also was very surprised that, for instance, the range of the different countries was more narrow than I thought. I, for instance, totally missed Eastern European artists. But then the more I thought about it, I realized that it is a completely different approach. It's like a very theoretical approach, and it's basically about Western society, and this is also a reason that you don't find Eastern European artists there, because they don't work about this subject, obviously.
You lived in former GDR, former Eastern, right, Europe, up until the fall of the Berlin Wall?
Yes, I did.
So since then you moved into the West and now New York. So that must give you another perspective, let's say, on this work that you're looking at here, this international work.
I'm very much interested for myself, for instance, in New York. I'm trying to introduce artists from Eastern Europe, for instance, in New York. I'm going to curate a show with my friend who is American and an art critic in New York, and we want to introduce more Eastern European artists in America. So I just wanted to say that it was for me a surprise, but now I begin to understand that the Documenta is just a very particular show where painting doesn't have a place, because it seems to be about art history in Western countries.
Here we are now in Munster. Have you had an opportunity to see very much of the Munster Sculpture Project?
Yeah, I have seen almost everything. It's of course a lot of fun to ride the bike around from one work to the other. There are so many pieces that somehow seem to communicate isolation. There are so many constructions that can be looked into but not stepped into, like the islands of Andrea Sittel or Hans Haag or something beautiful you would like to reach it, but you can't. That seems to be very dominant. I find that interesting. I appreciate that the artists seem to have a lot of freedom here compared with the Documenta, where they basically had to show a piece that was chosen by the curator. And it's nice to think about this difference of the curatorial approach. And I think it's big success, because it's good to think about these two shows, because I guess people can react more immediate to the work here, while at Documenta you really have to let it settle and think about it and come to a conclusion probably later.
I'm in the Landes Museum with Professor Paul Isenrath, who teaches sculpture at the Art Academy in Munster. Paul, I thought it would be interesting to ask you about your impressions of the sculpture project here. Perhaps you have some memories of past projects in 87 and even 77. But before we look backwards, perhaps we could ask you to say a word or two about your impressions of this particular sculpture project.
I think the main feature of the exhibition is a collection of ideas, and let's say realized with really with relatively modest materials, so that the ideas are in the foreground and the material in the background.
Do you think this is a great change from what happened in the last sculpture project, or were there works there which also had this conceptual quality and this use of simple materials?
It is not a change, but it is a development in this direction. In the first exhibition, the sculptors were in some way more traditional than today, and more and more it developed in the direction of pure ideas and of imagination.
One of the interesting things for me has been the way in which artists in this project seem to have found ways of, if you like, creating a new sort of monumental art.
I think what artists are doing today is in some way a modern form of what Tiepolo did in the 18th century. Let's say, but in the 18th century it was made for centuries, and now it is a temporary exhibition, but I think the function is a little bit like the paintings of Tiepolo. What Tiepolo made, it was made for a public, but not for a great public. And now it is, I would call it a democratic form of that, what Tiepolo did. It is for the whole public, and it is temporary. For we don't have enough buildings and enough space to conserve all these monuments for centuries. I think the contribution of contemporary artists to the public is that they show that thinking is possible outside of economic and scientific thinking. And the artists show that there's a possibility of another way of thinking.
Can I ask you, Paul, which of the pieces that you've seen so far in this project you have found the most memorable?
There are several pieces. There's the piece of Hans Hake, which is a perfect image of Germany, maybe Europe today. The piece of Nam June Paik, which seems to be from far only a decoration, but when you look into the cars through the front window, you see all the old electronic instruments, and it is even a little bit horror. I think that makes the power and the deepness of this work.
Can I ask you finally what it means to work as a sculptor and as a teacher of sculpture in this city, especially during this period when you have this extraordinary project going on around you?
I think it's very good for the students to have this exhibition. They have the opportunity to meet artists from all over the world and to compare what these artists are doing with their own development.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah.